Well, I'm happy to introduce Alan Stacey, whom I met when I went with a friend to Tor House in Carmel, and he was the docent who was assigned to us, and he gave us a fine tour of the of Tor House, which is the home that Robinson Jeffers built when he and his wife came to Carmel to live. And Alan also read or recited some poems here and there as we went around through the grounds and the buildings. So I thought it would be very nice to hear his thoughts on Robinson Jeffers, his own experience of Robinson Jeffers, and what connections there might be incidentally or purposefully with Buddhist thought or Buddhist experience. As far as Alan himself is concerned, I thought I'd give you an interior view. Inhaling fog, exhaling fog, beach cypress. Passing through the pines, the fog whispers news from the sea. Moment of silence, drained away by machines. Crows bitching at hawk, the cat's ears perk up. Looking at the crow, looking at me, sudden chill. In the dusk, crows fly home, random particles of night. A fence that keeps nothing in, nothing out, a long marriage. Waves crash, children scream, repeat. Drove all day, can't sit, can't stand still. Hearing wings beat the air, I realize I am still here.
So thank you. Well, thank you. Looking at my website. I want to thank you for inviting me here. Jerome, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be here to talk about one of my favorite poets, authors, writers, philosophers, Robinson Jeffers. As Jerome mentioned, I give tours at Tor House, so it's a little bit different leading people through the house and talking about different aspects of it. But I often focus on his poetry and let the poet speak for himself because he has so much to say to us today. He was one of the most famous and well-read poets of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And in fact, I usually start my little tour by saying, welcome to Robinson Jeffers' Tor House. his home, the home of one of America's most famous poets you've never heard of. and unfortunately, that tends to be true. He somewhat disappeared from our educational system after the 50s for a variety of reasons, one of which he was very adamant against our involvement in World War II or in wars in general, and spoke his mind in his poetry. And at that point in time, after we had finished defeating our enemies in World War II, the critics decided that he was no longer important or relevant and started dissembling him. And as a result, he kind of faded away from our educational system. Not that he cared that much. He went on living and writing and proving his points in his poetry. The thing about Jeffers' home in Carmel that we makes it so interesting to see is that it consists of a main building, a little small English-type cottage, a 40-foot tower called Hawk Tower, and several other structures, a dining room, a garage, and a larger east wing that the younger children lived in later on. The thing interesting about it is that Jeffers built almost all of it by himself, stone by stone, and that includes hauling the stones up from the beach below, one by one, building the house, building the tower over the decades. And as the township of Carmel changed and people started filtering in around him, he planted over 2,000 trees around his little plot there, and to kind of keep out the hedge of humanity coming in. and so he had this pocket of his home, this stone home, and the wild Pacific on one side, and this forest of cypress, eucalyptus, and Monterey pines on the other. And that's where he created almost all of his poetry over the decades. He made a few trips to Ireland, one of their favorite places to go, and to Taos, New Mexico, at the invitation of Mabel Dodge Luhan. But he only wrote a few poems in either of those places. So the ones I'm going to share with you today in particular are all created at Tor House. The other thing about Jeffers and his work is that when he moved to Carmel in 1914 with his wife, Una, they started building their home there, he was still an unknown poet, and he was still unsatisfied with his own work. He thought what he had written so far was dribble. He used other terms for it than that. And so he was struggling, trying to find his own unique voice, his own unique style for his writing. And it was during the 4 years of building Hawk Tower, again, a 40-foot tower of granite stones hauled from the beach below, that he broke through and wrote his first major works, Tamar, Roan Stallion, Luna Point Sur, and Continent's End. And it was the act, we believe, of building with stone, of hauling the stone around, that changed him, changed his mind, that made him the poet he was. Maria, a lot of what I'm going to tell you today is quotes from him and from other people who knew him, because that kind of tells the story the best. But one of the things, if you're familiar with the writer Lauren Isley, who was one of his contemporaries, he was an anthropologist and an ecologist, a poet himself. He had met Jeffers through Ansel Adams, and he wrote this about him. Something utterly wild had crept into his mind. The sea-beaten coast, the fierce freedom of its hunting hawks, possessed and spoke through him. It was one of the most uncanny and complete relationships between a man and his natural background that I know in literature. He left me with a strong impression that I had been speaking with someone out of time, an oracle who would presently withdraw among nearby stones and pine wood. He had this effect on people. He had these sea gray eyes. He kind of looked through you, so people say. He was very quiet, but then when he did speak, he spoke his mind, and you knew you had heard the words of Jeffers. One of the things, people usually think of him as a pretty serious poet, which he was. Yes, he has a humorous side as well. He was once asked about his life and death, perhaps, and he said, I should be glad to live like this for several centuries, but good and evil are very cunningly balanced in the most favored lives. And I should not consider myself ill-used if I was to die tomorrow. That would be very annoying. So one of the other things, as Jeffers created his poetry, it divided itself into two categories. These fairly long, dramatic, and very dark tragedies, kind of modeled after the Greeks, like Roan Stallion and Tamar and Women of Point Sur. And then a lot of shorter poems, over 400 shorter poems that we generally read more today. These two branches of his poetry are defined by his philosophy, which he called inhumanism, which I always think sounds kind of harsh to our ears today, but it wasn't misanthropic at all. He really loved mankind, and by inhumanism, what he really meant by his own words is, we must learn to fall in love outward. And Jeffers believed that humanity, individuals, society, families, and humanity, up the scale there, we paid far too much attention to our inward troubles, our inward feelings, our inward lives. And the more we focused on those aspects of ourselves, the more trouble we got into. And this is what he wrote about in his darker tragedies, was the self-destruction of families, the egos that destroyed people, the way people treated the world around them, ultimately ended in some form of tragedy. His shorter poems sort of take the opposite spin on that. And he talked about how he felt where we belong in nature and how we should view our place in the world. When I was thinking about this talk and how it reflects upon Jeffers and some of the Buddhist principles of suffering and impermanence and non-duality, I see a lot of parallels, but I'm going to actually let you draw some of those yourself, and maybe we can have a discussion afterwards about how you feel that fits into it. But I want to use his examples to show you how he felt about, again, our place in the world. But one of the things he wrote, it kind of sums it up nicely. He says, "It seems to me that the whole human race spends too much emotion on itself. The happiest and freest man is the scientist investigating nature, or the artist admiring it, the person who is interested in things that are not human. Or if he is interested in human beings, let him regard them objectively as a small part of the great music. Certainly, humanity has claims on all of us. We can best fulfill them by keeping our emotional sanity, and this by seeing beyond and around the human race." Another aspect of Jeffers' poetry was his incorporation of the landscape into his works. The Carmel, Big Sur, the Santa Lucia Mountains, the ocean, of course, right next door to him, the Monterey Bay, all worked themselves into his poetry. Matter of fact, he said that the landscape around him played as much as an important role in his poetry as people did, as much of a character as the people were. Often he contrasted the people's lives with the quote-unquote permanence of the landscape, so the impermanence of people with the permanence of the landscape, and gave them both beautiful and the harsh living that they had. I want to read to you a little bit longer piece than I usually read on tours, because since I have you all here trapped. It's called "O Lovely Rock," and I think this is a wonderful introduction to Jeffers' view of the world. And this is about a hike he took basically back into the Ventana wilderness with his son and camping overnight. "Oh, lovely rock. We stayed the night in the pathless gorge of Ventana Creek up in the East Fork. The rock walls and the mountain ridges hung forest on forest above our heads, maple and redwood, laurel, oak, madrone, up to the high and slender Santa Lucian firs that stand up stared up the cataracts of slid rock to the star color precipices. We lay on gravel and kept a little campfire for warmth. Past midnight, only two or three coals glowed red in the cooling darkness. I laid a clutch of dead bay leaves on the ember ends and felted dry sticks across them and lay down again. The revived flame lighted my sleeping son's face and his companion's and the vertical face of the great gorge wall across the stream. Light leaves overhead danced in the fire's breath. Tree trunks were seen. It was the rock wall that fascinated my eyes and mind. Nothing strange. Light gray diorite with two or three slanting seams in it, smooth polished by the endless attrition of slides and floods. No fern or lichen, pure, naked rock. As if I were seeing rock for the first time. As if I were seeing through the flame-lit surface to the real and bodily and living rock. Nothing strange. I cannot tell you how strange. The silent passion, the deep nobility, and childlike loveliness, this fate going on outside our fates. It is here in the mountain like a grave, smiling child. I shall die, and my boys will live and die, our will go on through its rapid agonies of change and discovery. This age will die. And wolves have howled in the snow around a new Bethlehem. This rock will be here, grave, earnest, not passive. The energies that are its atoms will still be bearing the whole mountain above. And I, many packed centuries ago, felt its intense reality with love and wonder. This lonely rock. Do you get a sense of Jeffers' view of the world around him in that? He also understood, he had a very good understanding observing the land, the ocean, sky, and the stars. He was very aware of the impermanence of man, of tribes and society. He had a great sense of both natural history and geological time and astronomical time, as a matter of fact. His younger brother, Hamilton Jeffers, was an astronomer at Lick Observatory, and so they often communicated about the new discoveries of astronomy, and all this, again, was incorporated into his poetry. He was a great hiker and traveler around the area as well, and visited Tassajara Hot Springs, way back in the hills there, and came across the caves that were back there. I don't know if you've been back there to try and explore, but inside the caves of Tassajara are hand paintings by the Esalen Indians who used to live there or migrated through there, I should say. Matter of fact, Tassajara, my understanding is, means place of drying meat. So that's where they used to go in the fall to preserve their hunts. But back there, Jeffers explored and saw the cave paintings, the handprints on the cave walls, and again, thought that was an important part of our world. He writes this poem called Hands. Inside a cave in a narrow canyon near Tassajara, the vault of rock is painted with hands, a multitude of hands in the twilight, a cloud of men's palms, no more, no other picture. There's no one to say where the brown, shy, quiet people who are dead intended religion or magic, or made their tracings in the idleness of art. But over the division of years, these careful signs manual are now like a sealed message, saying, look, we also were human. We had hands, not paws. All hail you people with the cleverer hands, our supplanters in the beautiful country. Enjoy her a season, her beauty, and come down and be supplanted, for you also are human. On the tour of Tour House, we walk by the actual namesake of the house. When Jeffers and Una were first exploring Carmel and deciding where they wanted to build their own home, there was a hilltop on the side of the sea, and on that hilltop there were rock outcroppings, so 3, 4, or 5 large stones of granite jutting out of the landscape. And Una Jeffers was a great scholar of Irish history and literature, and she knew that those stones in Ireland are called Tors, and therefore, and they usually have some kind of spiritual or perhaps magical power there. So that's where she decided they were going to build their home, on the Tors, therefore the name Tor House, of course. As we go outside the back of the house facing the sea, the west side, the Tors are placed, are still there, of course, where they were originally. And there's one large Tor that actually is the cornerstone of the house. And Jeffers basically planted his house on that stone, knowing that it had been there for many thousands of years, and hopefully will be there for many more thousands of years. He even gave it a name, and this again comes from his association with his brother. He named it Thuban. And Thuban happens to be also the name of a star, named after a French astronomer, that used to be the North Pole star before Polaris moved into position of the North Star as we travel through the zodiac. So Jeffers knew that Thuban, the cornerstone of the house, had been looking up the night sky, since Thuban, the star, was the North Pole star, and probably will be there for maybe until the next time Thuban arrives back at the North Pole. He wrote a poem about it, of course, called To the Rock. It will be the cornerstone of the house. And again, it's another important poem that gives you a sense of Jeffers' long-term thinking. Old garden of grayish and ochre lichen, how long a time since the brown people who have vanished from here built fires beside you and nestled by you out of the raging sea wind. 100 years? 200? You have been dissevered from humanity and only known the stubble squirrels and the headland rabbits or the long fetlocked plow horses breaking the hilltop in December, seagulls following, screaming in the black furrow. No one touched you with love. The gray hawk and the red hawk touched you, where now my hand lies. So I have brought you wine and white milk and honey for the 100 years of famine and the 100 cold ages of sea wind. I did not dream the taste of wine could bind with granite, nor honey and milk please you. But sweetly they mingle down the storm-worn cracks among the mosses, interpenetrating the silent wing prints of ancient weathers long at peace, and the older scars of primal fire, and the stone endurance that is waiting millions of years to carry a corner of the house, this also destined. Lend me the stone strength of the past, and I will lend you the wings of the future, for I have them. How dear you will be to me when I too grow old, old comrade. And it was that Tor, the cornerstone of the house, that was sitting there waiting patiently, doing a form of zazen, while Jeffers passed away on a cold January evening in 1962 at the age of 75. There's a special little room at Tor House called, that we call it the guest room actually, but it has a single bed looking out the sea window. And that is where Jeffers passed away. Una, his dear wife and muse, had died about 11 years before that, and it took him a while to recover from that, and maybe perhaps he never really did recover. He probably would have preferred to have joined her right away, but she made him promise to go on and writing poetry and enjoying grandchildren who were growing up there. But that stone was there waiting for him, and maybe carrying him forward into the future. At the same time, William Everson, who was a poet and worked here at UC Santa Cruz, was running the Lime Kiln Press. I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but he was a fine book printer and a poet in his own right. And he wrote a eulogy for Jeffers at that point in time that he later updated and did a book on. I just wanted to share the first three verses of that. In honor of Jeffers. This is actually the 50th anniversary of his passing this year. Everson wrote, "The poet is dead. In the evening, the dusk stipples with lights. The long shore gathers darkness in and of itself and goes cold. From the lap of silence, all the tide crests, pivotal immensity, lifts into the land. Snow on the headland, rare on the coast of California. Snow on Point Lobos, falling all night, filling the creeks and the backcountry, the strangely beautiful setting of death. For the poet is dead, the pen, splintered on the sheer excesses of vision, unfingered, falls. The heart-crooked hand, cold as stone, lets it go down. I mentioned earlier that Jeffers' fame sort of took a hit when he became an outspoken pacifist about involvement in World War II. And he, again, quite blatantly named names of politicians and blamed them for getting us into this awful war again. But he, it really, that whole episode of his life followed deeply his own philosophy of our place in the world. And this is something he wrote on one of his few speaking tours that he gave. He didn't really like to read his own poetry out loud. He almost refused to do it. He did it once with on a tour because he needed the money. But he did give several talks at the Library of Congress and at Harvard and Yale and several other Eastern universities. And this one section here really, again, defines Jeffers and gives you an insight into how he thought about our place in the world. And this isn't the poem, this is, again, this is his words and his speech. A man whose mental processes continually distort and prevent each other so that his energy is devoted to introversion and the civil wars of the mind is an insane man, and we pity him for it. But the human race is similarly insane. More than half of its energy are devoted to self-interference, self-frustration, self-incitement, self-tickling, self-worship. The waste is enormous. We're able to commit and endure it because we are so firmly established on this planet. Life is so easy that it requires only a slight fraction of our common energies. The rest we discharge into each other in conflict and charity, love, jealousy, hatred, competition, government, vanity, and cruelty, and the will to power. This is a tragic incest, and so I presented it. So in my poems. But we have all this excess energy. What should we do with it? We could take a walk, for instance, and admire the landscape. That is better than killing one's brother in war, or trying to be superior to one's neighbor in time of peace. We could dig our gardens. We could give ourselves to science or art, not to impress somebody, but for the love of beauty that each discloses. We could even be quiet occasionally. We have now won two world wars, neither of which concerned us. We were slipped in. We have leveled the powers of Europe that were the powers of the world into rubble and dependence. We have won two wars, and a third is coming. This one will not be so easy. We were at ease while the powers of the world were split into factions. We've changed that. We have enjoyed fine dreams. We have dreamed of unifying the world. We are unifying it against us. Two wars, and they breed more. Now guard the beaches, watch the north, trust not the dawns, probe every cloud, build power. Fortress America may yet for a long time stand between the east and the west, like Byzantium. As for me, laugh at me, I agree with you. It is foolish business to see the future and screech at it. One should watch and not speak, and patriotism has run the world through so many blood lakes, and we always fall in.
Did you say blood lakes?
Blood lakes. Poetic way of saying lakes of blood. after Una had passed away, Jeffers sort of slipped into not necessarily depression, but obviously a longing to join her, and often wrote his final poems about death, about his own death. One of his last great works was called Hungerfield, and it's about a man who comes back from World War II after seeing all the horrors of war and finds his mother dying of some awful disease and watches her at night until death comes to take her. And he decides that that's not going to work. He's going to fight death. And so in the story, he physically fights with death, grapples with her, the spirit of man against spirit of death, and wins. Death goes away, leaving his mother alive. But then for 24 hours, nothing in the world dies. And so Jeffers writes about that, what it's like to try to defeat death, to cheat death, and all of the... And the fact that his mother, in fact, wanted to die. She was ready, and he stole that from her. And a lot of that has to do with Una's dying of cancer, the way she passed away. So he was quite chilled by that whole process. Here's a poem called The Deer Lay Down Their Bones. And it's you can tell that this is what he was thinking about as he's exploring the landscapes of the mountains around him. I followed the narrow cliffside trail halfway up the mountain, above the deep river canyon. There was a little cataract crossed a path, flinging itself over the tree roots and rocks, shaking the jeweled fern fronds, bright bubbling water, pure from the mountain. But a bad smell came up. Wondering at it, I clambered down the steep stream some 40 feet, and found in the midst of bush oak and laurel, hung like a bird's nest on the precipice brink, a small hidden clearing, grass and a shallow pool. But all about there were bones lying in the grass, clean bones and stinking bones, antlers and bones. I understood that the place was a refuge for wounded deer. There are so many. Hurt ones escape the hunters and limp away to lie hidden. Here they have water for the awful thirst and peace to die in, dense green laurel and grim cliff make sanctuary, and a sweet wind blows upward from the deep gorge. I wish my bones were with theirs, but that's a foolish thing to confess, and a little cowardly. We know that life is, on the whole, quite equally good and bad, mostly gray neutral, and can be endured to the dim end, no matter what magic of grass, water, and precipice, and pain of wounds makes death look dear. We've been given life and have used it, not a great gift perhaps, but in honesty should use it all. Mine's empty since my love died. Empty? The flame-haired grandchild with gray-blue eyes that look like hers? What can I do for the child? I gaze at her and wonder, what sort of man in the fall of the world? I am growing old. That is the trouble. My children and little grandchildren will find their way. And why should I wait 10 years yet, having lived 67, 10 years more or less, before I crawl out on a ledge of rock and die snapping like a wolf who has lost his mate? I am bound by my own 30-year-old decision. Who drinks the wine should take the dregs. Even in the bitter leaves and sediment, new discovery may lie. The deer in that beautiful place lay down their bones. I must wear mine. Jeffers had many visitors at Tor House, of course. You know, they wanted to come see the famous poet. Una was the social part of the marriage, but he often would sit and listen to people who would visit. There were lots of quote-unquote famous people and not-so-famous people. He met world travelers, and there's a gentleman whom I have not quite memorized his name yet. He was an Indian mystic who came to visit him, And this poem called Credo came from that visit. My friend from Asia has powers and magic. He plucks a blue leaf from the young blue gum and, gazing upon it, gathering and quieting the god in his mind, creates an ocean more real than the ocean, the salt, the actual appalling presence, the power of the waters. He believes that nothing is real except as we make it. I, humbler, have found in my blood, bred west of the Caucasus, a harder mysticism. Multitude stands in my mind, but I think that the ocean in the bone vault is only the bone vault's ocean. Out there is the oceans, the water is the water, the cliff is the rock, come shocks and flashes of reality. The mind passes, the eye closes, the spirit is a passage. The beauty of things was born before eyes and sufficient to itself. The heartbreaking beauty will remain when there's no heart to break for it. Are we doing on time?
Are we on time?
Do we have a time?
It's 12:35. Do you want to keep going?
A couple more poems? Is that good?
We can. It's about our lunchtime. Okay. Maybe some.
How about I finish up with one more, and then glad to take any discussion. let's see. Actually, I like Vulture. This is one of my favorite poems. I have to read Vulture.
Good.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Again, Jeffers was a great walker and hiker, and so he often would just stroll over to Point Lobos from Tor House and explore there. And this is a poem he wrote when he was over there called Vulture. I had walked since dawn and lay down to rest on a bare hillside above the ocean. I saw through half-shut eyelids a vulture wheeling high up in heaven, and presently it passed again, but lower and nearer, its orbit narrowing. I understood then it was under inspection. I lay death still and heard the flight feathers whistle above me and make their circle and come nearer. I could see the naked red head between the great wings, bare downward staring. I said, "My dear bird, we are wasting time here. These old bones will still work. They are not for you." But how beautiful you looked gliding down those great sails. How beautiful you looked veering away in the sea light over the precipice. I tell you solemnly that I was sorry to disappoint him. To be eaten by that beak and become part of him, to share those wings and those eyes, what a sublime end of one's body. What an ensconcement. What a life after death. I'm sure that will sound familiar to people of the Buddhist tradition.
The Tibetan tradition.
And one last one he wrote called Inscription for a Gravestone. I know this seems kind of death-oriented, but just seems to be appropriate to end with. I admired the beauty while I was human. Now I'm a part of the beauty. I wander in the air, being mostly gas and water, and flow in the ocean. Touch you and Asia at the same moment. Have a hand in the sunrises and the glow of this grass. I left the light precipitate of ashes to earth for a love token. And my final haiku to Jeffers: without her, left to live on and on, this cold stone. So I hope that wasn't too morbid. Thoughts on Jeffers and inhumanism?
What was? Did he have a familial relationship to Ireland and his wife?
They both actually had British and Irish ancestry on both sides of their parents' families. So they had affinity definitely for Ireland in particular. And Una was very much into Irish music, Irish literature, and Irish towers. And therefore, Torhouse Hawk Tower, which was Jeffers built for Una, on the second floor is a little private room for Una. So that's kind of Una's sanctuary. So it's, you have this 40-foot tower of granite, and you have this nice little room he built for his wife. So.
Did he write in his tower?
He did not. He had his writing desk upstairs in the main, in the Torhouse itself. Upstairs is a sleeping loft for their bed and the two boys, they had twins' beds. And then in one corner he had a desk in the library where he wrote every day.
So the tower was?
Just for Una, really.
For her?
For her. And, well, I always say that the second floor is Una's room, and then the top of the tower where you have this amazing view of the whole coastline there is Jeffers' room. That's where he would repair to every evening before bed to check the weather or the stars. I had that last cigarette or something and think about the next day's words. Quite a life.
Now, was he caught up in this whole McCarthy thing?
Not really, no. By that time, he had more or less disappeared. he died in 1962, and again, his reputation had sort of diminished between World War II and his death, enough so that McCarthy didn't want to be bothered with him, I don't think. He just wasn't that important anymore. Which I think he was glad of. But
and what about his descendants? Where are they, his children?
Well, both his children, Donnan and Garth, have passed away as well. Donnan and his wife, Lee, raised their four children at Torhouse, and they were in danger of losing the property due to the increase in property taxes and cost of living there. And so that's when, in the mid-70s, local people such as Ansel Adams and got together some people and said, we must preserve this this buildings. And so they got together and raised enough money to purchase the property from Don and Lee with the provision they could continue living there. But they would then turn it into a protected foundation so that they could later on, of course, give tours and preserve it that way, preserve Jeffers' memory.
Where was he born?
I was born in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, in 1887, and spent most of his young years going to private schools in Europe. His father was very big on educating the two boys properly, and so those years they spent there, plus university years, gave them a very broad classical education. By the time they were teenagers, they both knew five languages, Greek, Latin, Italian, German, I think French too, and we're very well versed in the classics. Another reason why he was so upset with the wars is because he had seen what World War I had done to Europe, having lived there, and he knew and admired the countrysides, and he knew that it was destroyed by that war, and just saw it happening all over again in World War II. So another connection for him was that.
So who were his principal influences?
Ooh. So his influences?
Yeah.
That's a good question, because he enjoyed all the classics. He modeled a lot of his plays on the Greek tragedies, Euripides. He liked Hardy and Yeats. Whitman was one of his contemporaries, and I think he admired his work, but didn't extract much from that. So it's interesting that Yeats and Young were both building towers at the same time that Jeff was building his tower. Mm-hmm. And And I don't know if they probably didn't know that was happening at the time, but it was something guys did, I guess. They had to build towers.
Anybody else have a question before lunch?